So my instruction from Bruno is, yeah, get it done quickly because we don't want to miss the lunch. So, and I also have to watch out for what I'm saying because I'm being recorded. So since I'm the first talk, you'll hopefully forgive me for giving you a little bit of background, assuming it's a bunch of you are probably bored of hearing me. You were bored of hearing me 10 years ago, but some of you may not have heard me ever. So you've heard this. This is from Feynman's. And so the simplest form of the problem of turbulence is to take a pipe that is very long and push water through it at high speed. And as you know, high speed means more than 2 centimeters per second in the pipe of about 10 centimeters. So that's basically the turbulence is everywhere. It's ubiquitous. And the problem he was referring to, of course, is this picture we've seen many, many times. You know, Reynolds flow down a pipe. And like Predrag would say, well, this is plumbing, right? If you have water down a pipe. And if you're a physicist, well, you're not interested in plumbing. And I took this from a book by Tenekes and Lumley, 1972, A First Course in Turbulence. And actually, that's the first page of the book. And there they start with a discussion of what turbulence is. And one of the characteristics is that it's irregular, it's random. And there's this interesting statement in there, given what we're doing here, that the deterministic approach is impossible, and instead we have to rely on statistical methods. And that's, I think, what's been fascinating to physicists, is that maybe, you know, there is a statistical mechanics of fluid dynamics. And for most physicists, when you talk to, like, for instance, Boris, who's not here, and others, I'll go back to this, what's interesting about turbulence is that maybe it's not just plumbing. It doesn't matter what geometry you have. If you have a sufficiently high Reynolds number, so basically if the ratio of these two length scales, the dissipation scale and the outer scale of the scale of your system is sufficiently big, then there is a range, this is the theory, that there is a range of scales in between the outer scale and the viscous scale, and that in that range of scales, basically the turbulence would be homogeneous, isotropic, it would forget about how the energy has been input. And there's this Kolmogorov theory that if you look at the two-point velocity correlations, it would scale like r to the two-thirds, where r is the separation between the two points. And this is theoretically very appealing or seductive for people, that the turbulence could be universal. And there's a connection now that excites a lot of people between this theory that has been around for, 70 years, and the smoothness of Navier-Stokes in the order equations. So this is not plumbing to people. This feels more general than plumbing. And after Reynolds, probably one of the experiments that influenced a lot of people, I think this is probably the kind of experiment that influenced Kolmogorov and Onzager and those people, is grid turbulence. If you're looking for what's the canonical experiment, is it flow down a pipe or is it flow behind a grid? So this is the kind of experiment that was done a little before World War II. You have a grid here, there's a flow that's coming in, and you can see von Karman vortex streets, what we call current structures, but then they interact, right? The flow becomes very disordered, and this is what probably we would like to study, turbulence. We, not me, but maybe some people. So maybe this is the pure turbulence experiment. But if we look at it from our point of view, this is decaying turbulence. And you can show, and it's very easy to do, there's no forcing. So there is, in our language, we would say there's no organizing center. In fact, this is just decaying, and whatever your initial perturbations are, the global attractor is just V equals zero. Everything's dying out. So there's no structure. It's very, very disordered. And when I started in the turbulence field, there was really these two camps. You know, people thought the way to study turbulence actually is to just look at turbulent decay, because you don't want to influence the flow. You start with some initial condition, you let it evolve, and you just have turbulence decay. The other canonical problem for many people is turbulence in a periodic box. And of course, this started with Orszag and Patterson in 1972. Again, this is like maybe the ideal turbulence problem from some people's point of view. So you have a triply periodic box, and either, again, you do decay or you do forcing. You force typically at large scales. And the kind of question that people are looking for is there some general organizing principle for the turbulence dynamics? And one of the key things that people have been obsessed about, including myself, not so obsessed, but I've worked on this a little bit, is the influence of helicity in 3D turbulence. Is it possible that helicity has something to do with turbulence? And this picture that I'm showing you there is from a paper by Bifferali, where they look at interaction of various helical modes, and when you have when you restrict the interaction to just a certain type of helical mode, you can have an inverse cascade and creating an inverse cascade of helicity. And it's interesting talking about two-point correlation in single time. That's what you do. Next week, when we have a conference here, there's going to be another conference at not too far from here, exactly the same time, at IPAM. And they're also talking about turbulence, and the point of view is quite different. The point of view is, you know, spontaneous stochasticity, a breakdown of uniqueness of Lagrangian particle trajectories. And in some ways, we're talking almost about the opposite. We're going to talk about onset of coherence in this turbulence. And this is probably from Rayleigh-Binard convection. I don't know what picture this is, but it looks to me like this is Rayleigh-Binard convection and a transition to turbulence in that.
It's so, natural convection. They're just heating at the bottom.
Is it your computation?
No, but I know the paper.
Just heating at the bottom and starting from t equals zero, right?
Transient, right?
Yeah, yeah, it's a transient. That's what it looks like, yeah. And so again, same time, two different points, kind of the inertial range, right? The scale is about 100 miles, much smaller than the scale of the world. It's bigger than the human scale. So this is the inertial range in terms of interaction, but there's almost no correlation between that conference and our conference. I'm not sure that any of the people speaking here, visiting here, and I may try to go down there.
Falkovich.
Okay. Falkovich, yes. All right. So the Kolmogorov scaling theory, so this theory that I'm talking about and that seduces a lot of people, well, it's there. And it's there, and I want to emphasize this, if you stir enough. So there is some famous experiments from the 1960s, Grant Stewart and Molyet. We did measurements in a tidal channel in Seattle, fabulously high Reynolds number. I forgot if anyone remembers. But basically, you can see the Kolmogorov spectrum. If you do DNS in a triply periodic box, and you have forcing, you're forcing a sufficiently large band of wave number, or if you're forcing a sufficiently random at large scale, you see it. If you do experiments on smooth walls or Taylor Quet, you don't quite see it, but the trick that people do, like you probably have heard about this, the French wishing machine, you put blades in there, and again, you stir up the flow enough, and you see Kolmogorov, and so you're happy. But you don't quite see Kolmogorov. In fact, one of the main issues in this field is that there is intermittency. And intermittency...
Shryman has just arrived.
He just arrived, and he missed all my introduction to... Kolmogorov, and he likes Kolmogorov. You want me to?
Yeah.
All right.
We can stop this.
This is why I'm recorded. Hi, Boris. So this is I'm showing you a simulation again here. This is old, 1991. There's been many better simulations since then, but this is again in a periodic box. And you're forcing at large scale, you have a cascade, you see a Kolmogorov cascade, but then the small scales tend to organize, so it's almost the opposite here. There's emergence of coherence, and this is linked to intermittency. So you see all these tubes of vorticity, these are vortex lines. So the small scale organize, and in many ways this emergence of coherent structure is limiting the Kolmogorov spectrum. So the Kolmogorov spectrum, my impression is that this is almost like the ultimate... a state of dissipation in Navier-Stokes, but the dynamical equations have all these, what we will call coherent structures, that attract the dynamics of the flow and actually limit the transport of energy to small scales. So for me, what's more interesting, and I think Clancy Rowley is here, is that
yep.
correct? Yeah, that's you, right?
It is.
Did you do this for your PhD thesis? Or?
My student did it for hers, yeah.
Uh-huh. So what's more interesting, I think, for turbulence from my point of view is that if you have flow, this is channel flow, right? So we're looking from the flow. You have two walls, two rigid walls. You have a pressure gradient, which is steady, very nice and smooth. The walls are perfectly smooth. And if you have perfectly smooth channel flows with smooth, steady forcing, you get these very complicated flows with a lot of structure near the wall, which are perfectly smooth. So there's no blades, there's no randomness. People often mention the fact that in any real experiment, you're going to have a roughness of the wall, and that disturbs the flow, and that's the problem we want to study. And maybe we do, but from a more mathematical point of view, what is interesting to me is that in these smooth flows, with smooth forcing, you get these kind of complexity and these structures, as we know, right? So most of the structures are near the wall in this general flow. You recognize the structures. There's an organization to it. We know them well. Well, some of us do. And here's a completely different type of flow. This is from Detlef Loza's group at University of Twente. This is a DNS, Rayleigh-Binet convection. So we're looking from the top. You have a hot plate, a cold plate on top, and we're looking at the temperature field very close to the bottom plate. So red is hot, and blue is cold, and we have all these sheets of hot fluid going up. So that's, again, you know, smooth walls, steady forcing, and yet the flow creates these very complicated structures. So the coherent approach to turbulence that most of us here are involved with is to recognize the fact that in turbulence you have all these poorly defined coherent structures, vortices, streaks, front plumes, and the goal here is to extract these multiscale exact current structures from the equation. And I like to emphasize this, not from the data. There's a lot of techniques in turbulence where you simulate all this data, you create all this data, and then you try to extract from the data some typical current structures, you know, proper orthogonal decomposition and techniques like this. But here we're trying to extract these structures from the equations directly. And by exact current structures, you all know this, we mean steady state solution of the Navier-Stokes equation, traveling wave solutions of the equation, or time periodic solution of the equation. And these solutions are typically unstable, yet they can capture most of the statistics, or many of the interesting statistics, such as the global transport, the mean velocity profile, the mean temperature profile, the root mean square velocity profiles, with a single solution. Most of our work has been done in plane quad flow, or quasi shear flows, pipe flow, channel flow. But I'll present some work here on convection pretty soon. And I think this is the kind of solutions we're going to talk about. So you've seen this one. This is channel flow. And these are the ones I'll mention a little bit also. This is in Rayleigh-Binet convection. So these are the example of exact current structures that we're talking about. For me, I was a little bit involved from the side with this work. So this is the famous Kim-Moyen and Moser DNS of channel flow. So the flow is going from left to right. We're looking at the bottom wall. And what's visualized here is skin friction. So when you have turbulence, the flow transports more momentum. There's more drag at the wall. But the drag at the wall actually has these very long, streaky region of low drag, and then pockets of high drag. And around 1990, I was a postdoc at CTR, Center for Turbulence Research at Stanford, and Derek Stretch was my office mate, like here. We had offices 2x2. And what he was doing was basically analyzing this data. And the question he was asking is, whenever you have a hot spot of high shear at the wall, what kind of flow structure do you see here? And the work he did was isolate another flow structure, and then try to correlate, maximize the correlation between the flow structures to see what is the typical structures associated with these hotspots. And here's the cartoon he came up with of the typical structure associated with high drag regions of these hotspots. And they consist of, very well known, low-speed streaks, staggered quasi-streamwise vortices. So we're seeing several cuts here. So this is the drawing that he made from analyzing the DNS data. And then a little later on, we were able to construct, we being many people here, not that person. And so here's an example in channel flow. I'm sure many of you have seen this one. This is a 3D traveling wave solution in channel flow. The top wall here is actually the center line, so there is no drag at the center line. The bottom wall is no slip, and you see a wavy low-speed streak with staggered quasi-streamwise vortices, very much like like the picture that Derek Stritch had drawn from analyzing the DNS data. And if you go a little further, so this is something I did, is you can ask the question, all right, what is the minimum Reynolds number, which is effectively the minimum length scale in the vertical direction, at which these solutions stop existing? And what's interesting about this is that when you look at the data, and that was well known, the typical spacing between these streaks is about 100 wall units. The typical waviness is about 300 wall units. So this is in channel flow. And when you maximize, when you optimize these solutions, this is almost exactly the numbers that you get. So the smallest Reynolds number for which this solution exists is 44 in wall units, and this is obtained for a streamwise length of about 300 wall units, just like the experiments were mentioning, and a spanwise length about 100, again, just like the data was showing. And these numbers are fairly consistent. So there's other solutions that have been found, and typically this is the sort of minimal length scale that you find for existence of this solution. So I think this is nice, but we haven't done much work really to connect this beyond that observation and these high Reynolds number simulations. If you increase the Reynolds number, you're going to get more and more streaks. We haven't connected yet these exact current solutions to the near wall streaks, even though this is what people tend to say, that this is a near wall solution. Well, in fact, no, it's not a near wall solution. It fills the entire channel, right? So the connection between this so-called near wall solution and this full solution has not been done yet. And about 10 years ago, I'm showing you here some data for similar solution in Quetflow. So the data is not really that important. The important point is that this is the Reynolds number. Over there, this is the shear at the wall. And as these solutions, there's a bunch of solutions that come in. They typically come in through a saddle node bifurcation. And what we were talking about was trying to find the smallest point, and that's what gives you the scaling 100, 50, and 300 in terms of wall units. But around that time, so about 10 years ago, I tried to push this a little beyond just looking at the nodes and try to find the envelope of all these solutions. And Mike Graham and I actually talked about this. I don't know if you remember, Mike, about 10 years ago. We were talking about trying to track these solutions to high Reynolds number by being guided by the scaling that is observed in experiment of 100 plus, 300 plus, 500 plus, to see if there is some solution that maximizes transport. And I attempted to do this with a student at the time, Zhu Wang, but it was too difficult computationally. So we abandoned that calculation, trying to find. So again, the idea is at any Reynolds number, you have a multitude of solutions. And out of all those solutions, which one matter? So this is going to be related to a lot of the topic of this conference. So Predrag wants to calculate many of them and then create the periodic orbit expansion. But my more simplistic idea was just to try to figure out which one transports most momentum or the least amount of momentum. And again, for shear flow, this is pretty hard to do because they're 3D. So computing the envelope was too hard back when we tried in 2003, so we basically abandoned it. But I came back to it more recently in a much simpler problem of Rayleigh-Binard. And Rayleigh-Binard, everybody knows this. Again, this is a hot plate, cold plate. And as you increase the governing parameter here is the Rayleigh number, which I think I have defined here. So the governing parameter is the Rayleigh number. So it's essentially the temperature, the non-dimensional temperature difference between the two plates. The other important parameter is the Prandtl number, nu over kappa. And it's a much simpler problem because there's a nice bifurcation to a steady state from the conductive state. So if the Rayleigh number is greater than 1708, independent of Prandtl number, there is a favored length scale, which is about twice for no slip boundary conditions, about twice the separation between the walls. And when the Rayleigh number is bigger than that, then you bifurcate, the conductive state bifurcates to what I sketched here as the steady state. So we have steady convection rolls redistributing the temperature. So very much like we see in shear flows, right, where we have these convection rolls creating streaks. Well, here you create temperature. But here the temperature is sustaining the shear flow directly. So if you increase, if you follow this bifurcation, so I'm showing you the typical Rayleigh Nusselt number. Nusselt is the non-dimensional heat flux. As you increase the Rayleigh number, so at 1708, we have a bifurcation from the convective state to a steady state. So this is a stable steady state, right? This is the single pair of convection rolls. At Rayleigh around 54,000, that steady state becomes unstable to a Hopf bifurcation. So you get a periodic stage where the plumes are going up and down rhythmically. So this is the maximum transport and the minimum transport. You keep going. Eventually, you have a bifurcation to chaos. And what we're showing here is just an illustration. You're showing the local max as a function of time. And this is not yet turbulence. This bifurcation is a little bit the same situation as in shear flow. There's many, many of these steady states. And what I'm showing you here, the green line, is essentially the same process. But instead of having a length scale of 2 to 1, it's 4 to 1. So we have a double pair of convection rolls. And so if you want a double pair of convection rolls to come in to the problem, the Rayleigh number needs to be higher. One interesting thing is that as you increase the Rayleigh number, eventually the double pair transports more heat than the single pair. This double pair eventually would also have its Hopf bifurcation, but at a much higher Rayleigh number. Well, much higher, significantly higher. So we'll have a similar series of bifurcation for that double pair solution, but transporting more heat and also being stable for a longer time. If you take a triple roll, quadruple roll, you'll keep seeing the same sort of picture. So one question we asked here is two questions, actually. What happens to the unstable steady state? So the unstable steady state, of course, as you know, is still there. One obvious question is the unstable steady state a good estimate of the average of the turbulent flow, for instance? And another one is, well, what about tracking a solution, what we were trying to do with this envelope idea, tracking a solution which is maximizing the heat transport? And if you're maximizing the heat transport, how do you do this for the steady state? So everything comes from 1708 in convection, much simpler than in shear flows. In shear flows, we're not quite sure what is the fundamental solution to track. We all have our ideas, probably. But then as we increase the Rayleigh number, and I'm tracking a steady state here, but a steady state which is, I'm going to let the length scale adjust to maximize heat transport. And the kind of solutions we're finding, these are solutions that are quickly rejected by experimentalists, as we never see this in the real world. Indeed, we don't, but these are solutions of the Businesk equation. So this is the solution I'm showing you here is this solution, the fundamental solution, the double pair of rolls. And if we keep on computing it to much higher, so this is really 160,000, we computed it to 410 to the 7, so 40 million. This is for Prandtl 7. You might be a little bothered by this noise here, but what I'm showing you here, this is the temperature equals zero, the zero contour, and effectively the temperature is zero pretty much everywhere. So the temperature is about 0.2 over here, 1 at the bottom wall, minus 1 at the top wall, teeny boundary layers right there. And then essentially these arms drop off. They're very close to zero. So in fact, here the temperature is of order 10 to the minus 10. This is computed using Newton's method in Fourier space, in Chebyshev space. So the residuals are, or the relative residuals is like 10 to the minus 11. So extremely well resolved, but still we're not capturing this little noise in the solution. So this solution, this is the primary solution, what we call the primary solution. So it's one of these current structures. This is the one that comes at 1708, and we just crank it up to a higher Rayleigh number. And initially, so you're redistributing the temperature, and as you increase the Rayleigh number, these rolls just get bigger and bigger, and they wrap up the temperature profile. So again, what you're seeing here is the zero contour, but this is mostly zero temperature with a thin plume here and a thin plume down there. The other solution, this one, doesn't look very different here. The one that maximizes transport is a solution that's obtained by tracking a steady state but reducing the only free parameter we have here. This is 2D, is the horizontal length scale. And so we reduce the length scale as suggested by these two curves. The blue curve is, again, L of H equals 2. The green curve is L of H equals 4. So we increase the length. We decrease or increase the wave number, decrease the length scale. And usually I show, you know, the process for increasing Rayleigh number. But as you go to higher Rayleigh number, the aspect ratio is correct here. So we're almost at 10 to the 10, 7, 10 to the 9, huge Rayleigh number. So if we're comparing to quet flow, this is Reynolds number about 10 to the 5 for quet flow. Teeny boundary layers, and again a plume. But what is interesting is that we have asymptote to some sort of asymptotic structure. So this structure, this jagged structure, again, you don't see that in experiments. But this jagged structure seems to be the asymptotic structure of these solutions. And of course, the big question is, how does it scale in terms of Nussel versus Rayleigh scaling? So we're looking here in log, on the log-log plot, Rayleigh number, Nussel, the heat transport, and the solution with these long arms that are wrapping up. Here's the data. And it gives you a scaling for the Rayleigh number of about 0.24 Rayleigh to the 1/4. This is not a fit. This is an eyeballing of the slope. The dashed line is the Rayleigh to the 1/4. More interesting is the scaling of the optimum solution. And interestingly also, since the length scale are getting smaller, this is a trick that we've seen several times in tracking these coherent structures. If you want to maximize transport, you need to reduce the length scale. If you're reducing the length scale, you don't need as much resolution to go to higher values of the parameters. So this is kind of nice for a change. So this is why computing the solution with these spiral armbands is pretty hard to do, right? The primary solution, computing the optimum solution is much easier. So we're basically at 10 to the 10 right now. And basically, it's a numerical issue. And I'm thinking about this now because the method we're using are basically ridiculous for these kind of solutions. Essentially, nothing happened here. It's almost like a constant. All the actions right there and here, right? And so even with Chebyshev, you know, I have 200 points probably for this, and almost nothing happens right there. So we need better method, or I need better method to resolve the boundary layers and these corner regions better without using all my memory to over-resolve all the interior. It's non-trivial to do, though, because in terms of the asymptotics, I don't know if this pointer works. It's non-trivial. We have teeny, teeny boundary layers. They're absurdly small right here. We have these corner regions that need to be resolved. The plume in the middle needs to be resolved. So it's not just the standard boundary layer analysis where you have an interior and a boundary layer. You have boundary layers, but you also have these corner regions that need to be resolved. Most of the nonlinearity is happening right here. And it's over here, all the scales are about the same. So the asymptotics is not trivial to do. Although maybe Phil Hall...
That's like Greg Kinney's here.
Yeah, or maybe... Luckily, Phil Hall is not here. Because whenever I talk about asymptotics at a talk and then Phil Hall is there, then a few months later I get a paper saying, I solved your problem. So, it's good for science. So here's the scaling of these optimum solution. And of course, what's interesting is, some of you know this, there are some rigors bound on the transport of heat in Rayleigh-Binet convection. There's a bound for no slip, a bound for free slip. They're much higher, but what's quite interesting is that this is the data. This is the 3D turbulent data. And the 3D turbulent data, I'm showing you several sets, including some sets from here at UCSB, from Günter Arles' group. I don't remember which one it is, if it's the dashed line or the dashed dot. The squares are actual real data from Srinivasan and Nima. And the scaling is almost identical. In fact, when you look at the numbers more closely, this exponent, some people laugh at 309 really, isn't 0.31, but 0.309 seems to work pretty well. The data seems to have a prefactor of 0.105 instead of 0.118. So the data, which is 3D data, this is a 2D optimum solution, is extremely close to what this flow does. You know, this kind of flow, with all its complexity here, has a heat transport, basically scales like this, and the optimum solution, this solution, gives you essentially exactly the same scaling, with slightly higher, which would make sense since we're looking for an optimum solution. And, well, that's the kind of thing I'm interested in. How could that be? How could it be that a 2D solution? Well, you almost see the answer here, right? The fundamental structure in this convection tends to be these long sheets, right? So if the optimum solution captures the scale, the thickness of the sheet, the average spacing between these sheets, the typical velocity, typical temperature, then basically that's all you need to capture the transport. So it seems the suggestion here is that this optimum solution, this optimum steady state, this optimum coherent solution is really the fundamental structure to understand this type of flow. And I'll stop pretty soon. Basically, I think in terms of a few remarks, there's a nice convergence of work in what we've been doing in shear flows and also convection, Taylor Quett. For a long time, all these communities were not talking to each other, right? If you worked in shear flows or if you worked in convection, there was no connection between the two. But for instance, if you look at the problem of snaking that John and Tobias have done some nice work on, this is something that had been done in convection before, and now we're seeing the same kind of structures in shear flows. And another point that I want to emphasize here is that sometimes when I talk to these other turbulence people, I'm told, oh, you don't work on turbulence, you work on transition. And a lot of the work we've been doing is transition, but I want to emphasize here that it's not just transition. When we look at this, this kind of result, this is not transition, this is actually fully developed turbulence itself. So the simple coherent structures can capture, that's the message that we've been trying to pass for many, many years, can capture the transport of fully turbulent developed flow. And hopefully I haven't gone over my time, but I'll stop here and I'll take your questions. Mr. Graham.
Now this is really cool. Back to the previous slide, I'm sure this is something you've thought about. There's one of those filaments there in the upper right. If you just take a cross section of that, this is, let's see, is that a DNS or that's a DNS?
This is a DNS.
So there's this key local structure, which is where the boundary layers come together and form the, mm-hmm. right, the beginnings mm-hmm. of the plume, and that's yep. that's that filament. Has anyone gone in yet?
No, not yet.
Looked. I mean, the scalings of those things with railing.
Right.
It seems no. like a nice thing to do.
No, but nobody. That's an obvious thing to do. You see, and of course, people who do these kind of simulation would love to have this. They have all these databases. Would be to try to do some data analysis, right, to see what's the connection between the fully turbulent flows and these solutions. Like, for instance, again, the thickness. Does this thickness correlate? Does the spacing correlate? It, in some sense, it must, since the scaling is so good, right?
Actually, I'm one of the co-authors of those papers, uh-huh. and that is something we were trying to do now.
So you're trying to...
So one of the big problems of this...
So which author are you?
Ed Al.
Are you Ed or are you Al?
Depends on the day.
What's your name?
Rodolfo Stina. So the problem with that was it was really hard to define a shear velocity, because it's all moving around. So one of the postdocs that's now working on this problem is trying to do two parallel plates like this, so you have a always a coherent velocity. Uh-huh. And using that, you can track.
You mean very close to each other, or
like this?
But what's the spacing here? Hmm?
So you have also convection, but now there is like transport here, but you always have a velocity.
But you're not doing it in a very narrow slit, or?
No, with narrow slits, you actually get very different results. Mm-hmm. For some reason, the large-scale circulation does seem to be important. And there is a paper by Edwin van der Poel and me and others in 2014 about 2D Ray LeMenard and trying to get what was the minimum length you need. Mm-hmm. And you get very strange phenomena. So but we should talk later.
Yeah, this is 2D Ray LeMenard. So these solutions here are 2D.
Mm-hmm. But you get, if you run that simulation in 2D, what you get is an accumulation of energy somehow.
If you do a DNS, so time marching.
And then suddenly a burst, and then a very slow accumulation of energy again, a burst.
Okay, well, that's the Howard picture. The boundary layer instability building up.
Yeah.
Kind of
the Howard, the Lou Howard, not Howard Stone. Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Quick question. So, but I mean, to my eye, wouldn't you say that maybe the length scale of the sheet?
The length scale of, so
on that picture?
Yeah. Oops.
You know, plausibly has some connection with the.
So, length scale of the sheet, you mean this length or this length?
The latter.
The small one, yeah.
Thickness, thank you. Maybe has a connection with your 2D optimal transport solutions.
That's what you would expect.
The spacing between, at least if you go back to the sheet that you just pointed to.
The spacing, right, there's a loss.
That seems like, you know, these aren't high wave number solutions, right? It's in some sense, it seems like that to me is more like the branch you tracked from 1708 that you didn't adjust the wave number. So it still had a very narrow plume, but then there was this sort of core region, you know, that there was the finite spacing. The spacing between the plumes was order one. That, of course, has a different scaling, I realize, than DNS.
Yeah.
Observation. And maybe that spacing...
Well, and again, this is what this conference is about, right? It may be that both of these solutions, to simplify to the extreme, are important to the full dynamics. You see that.
And maybe with distance from the wall as well, there's some...
You're starting to talk in like an engineer now. Yeah.
Sorry.
Well, then the other thing, your optimal prediction that says what the if the DNS is close to it, then you just look at the spectrum of wave number spectrum
of the DNS. Yeah.
And see if it's close to the.
Yeah. The spectrum should be able to capture. I'm sure this is something you've done, right? What is the?
Before we sort of get started.
I have no idea what the time is. So.
Yeah. Well, kind of related. So you've done the optimization in 2D. If you did an optimization in 3D, would you get sheets? That be the
We haven't done it. I'll let you do that. You need to be smarter with computers and more data, bigger computers. But no, I don't think you will. I think you'll see. I think the optimum solution is, and it's again, I mean, this is just... Again, this suggests that the fundamental solution is a sheet. You see, if you want to transport heat, like Andrei Domaratsky at USC used to say, don't speculate, calculate. So now we have the power, we could calculate. But if I speculate, I would say that the optimum solution in 3D will be a sheet too. If you want to transport heat from the bottom to the top, why would you break it up into plumes? So we like to think of plumes, you know, these mushroom-type plumes, but it's not a very good way of transporting heat from the bottom to the top. A sheet is much better. You have to go up and you have to go down, right? So you can't go up everywhere. So a sheet is probably the optimum 3D solution. It's probably unstable, you see? So these solutions, one thing interesting, and this is something I went very quickly over, is that, you see, these bifurcation that we see in the primary solution, in the, you know, we don't see that in the optimum solution. There's no bifurcations. See, the only bifurcation there is to large scales, right? But then when we restrict the small, in fact, a lot of this data was computed with just a time marching code. The only problem is that as you go to higher rate of number, the solutions are basically stable in that box with mirror symmetry, right? However, they become very weakly stable. You see, so if you just wait for your time marching code to converge, it takes forever, so we have to speed it up. But they're quite stable solutions.
John.
Oh, it's just a comment on your don't speculate, calculate.
Yes.
Lumley told me.
Don't calculate.
Yeah, don't calculate, think. Don't compute, think.
We don't do that anymore.
Time for everything.
Yeah.
So, when you say sheet of what?
The sheet structure as opposed to just a blob.
But a sheet of what variable?
Temperature.
Well, velocity goes with it, right?
Well, I don't know.
What do you mean? Well, the velocity...
You can have sheets of vorticity, you can have sheets of lots of things. I just was wondering what sheet of what?
It was a simple question.
Sheet of fluid. These are very narrow structures. It's a sheet of whatever you want. The temperature is very localized. The velocity is very localized. The vorticity is very localized. You see, it's all extremely coherent. So it's a sheet of whatever you want.
But in this case...
See, these solutions here, the temperature is very concentrated here, goes up. The temperature is actually almost zero, as you can see. You know, the velocity that goes with this is almost constant, going straight up from top to bottom. So there's a very strong acceleration zone here, and then essentially you have constant velocity from top to bottom.
So if it's a constant velocity going up, what distinguishes that from a plume?
A plume being?
Well,
this is a
rising
plume.
Fluid. Well, I would call a plume. What do you call a plume?
What I call a plume would be, a mushroom-type solution, localized.
Okay, so
yeah.
It goes up and then loses its...
Yeah.
Okay.
So, basically the same, similar to these solutions, but axisymmetric.
So it's different when you have horizontal gradient of temperature. You have boundary, thermal boundary layer with sheets, but it's not plumes.
I missed the beginning. What did you say at the beginning?
When you have not really been a convection, but convection with horizontal gradient.
Uh-huh, horizontal gradient, yeah.
In this case, you have a turbulent boundary layer.
On the side, yeah.
Very
yeah.
strong shears, mm-hmm. not plumes on this. It is similar to the situation where you have turbulent convection with heat from the side.
I'm not sure.
Can be interesting to
see. So you're talking about a different problem where we're heating from the side.
And... Boundary layers, yes.
Okay.
Just a quick comment. I mean, why do you think that maximizing the Nusselt number is the right thing to do? As far as I know, no one has shown, and it's not even true, that the fluid wants to maximize the Nusselt number.
Well, this is data.
I understand,
right?
And that's very intriguing.
So what you so there's a confusion with that, right? So there's these upper bounds. Oops, I missed them. I have them here. Now there's these rigorous bound on maximum transport, but they don't satisfy the equation. They don't satisfy it. These are solutions of the equations, right? We don't know if it's the optimum. There might be some other solutions out there that transport more heat. I don't think there is. That would be very hard to show. But it is quite intriguing that the solution, the actual solution that maximizes transport, the actual steady solution that maximizes transport, is amazingly close to the scaling seen in 3D turbine data. So why do I think? You can give some, back-of-the-envelope arguments. The back-of-the-envelope argument is that this is survival of the fittest, right? If you have a solution like this, it just wipes out all the temperature profile. Any other kind of motion has nothing to sustain them, and so they disappear. The only thing is that these solutions are not stable themselves in a sufficiently large domain. So they give you this state of flow if you put them in a large domain. But the fundamental structure, the one that sucks up all the available potential energy, they would say in meteorology, is the solution that transports the most heat.
I know various counterexamples to that argument, so maybe we can talk about that.
I'm sure they are, right? And in fact, maybe going back to this, if you take free slip boundary conditions, for instance, especially in 2D, then all the energy seems to be going into a shear flow. You see? So you don't maximize the transport. But with no slip...
Sure, that's right. In 2D with free slip, that's right, yes.
2D free slip, the numerical, again, calculating, not speculating, all the energy seems to be going in shear flows. So you're not transporting... all the heat.
Before I get to this, I have too much on this. Two more questions and then the next one.
Couldn't this be saying that the these rigorous bounds things are really very primitive and barking up the wrong tree, and they're, I mean, those are the bounds that people have found, but maybe they're much better bounds that, maybe the truth of the problem, all the disagreement, all would be within that kind of scaling that you have, and those are really bad, bad bounds.
This is the question of rigor, right? So these bounds are rigorous bounds. This is hopefully a correct numerical simulation. You see that looks at a certain type of solution. We don't know that this is the optimum. It could be that there's something else.
Maybe they're rigorous bounds. Well, at the same time, this suggests maybe ways to construct
better rigorous bounds.
Yeah, and Rich Kurzweil actually has some ideas about this that he's been trying to get me to work on, so to try to show that this might actually be a rigorous bound.
Well, it's just a comment on what Edgar said. I mean, Edgar's right. I mean, it may want to transport, you know, heat in the most efficient way, but the key question then is the degree...
Right or wrong?
Sorry? The key question then is the degree to which the system allows you to do that, and whether these solutions are ever stable. And in some systems, well, it seems in this system, it's key, it's true that, you know, this is very close to being the right answer. But in some other systems, things just prevent you from doing these things. They could be shear flows. So then the question is, what are the coherent structures that stop this optimal transport? That would be an interesting question.
That's what this meeting is about,
yeah.
Again. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a really interesting question.
Yeah, it's not. I'm not saying that, you know, the solution that maximizes transport is always the one. You know, no. It's just.
Well, transport of what? I mean,
whatever flow. You know, if you have shear flows, transport of momentum. If you have convection, transport of heat. You see, so in many of these flows, there is a what.
Yeah, there may be more than one.
There may be more than one.
Okay. Thank you very much, Wally.